Okay, it is February the 8th, and we are in Parashas Vayeshev on page 198. Last time we described in detail the status of Yosef, and we already presented how Yosef's position amongst the brothers was rife for trouble. It was already set up, it was kind of almost set up for trouble, because Yosef, on the one hand, is meant to be the leader of the brothers, and we showed how he is not exactly, he's not an Av, he's not a patriarch, but yet he's not a Shevet, he's not one of the tribes either, he's kind of in the middle. So he has this quasi-patriarch status, yet he is the 11th out of 12 sons, and therefore it's very difficult for him to be viewed as someone who is a leader. Not only that, we showed from the way that the Torah introduces him that he did not act in a way that would command that kind of respect that would make people treat him older than his years. So that's the setup that we have before we begin with Yosef. There are probably more chairs behind the partition.
Yeah, there are
plenty
of chairs.
Yeah. Let's slide together. You're getting real nice and cozy. Okay. Now, what we're going to do this week is we're going to make a presentation about what exactly is the dispute between the brothers and Yosef. We know there are going to be dreams. We know there's going to be jealousy. But I'm going to show you that it runs deeper than that, and that the dispute that they have actually is quite an intricate one, and one that is precisely because of how learned and knowledgeable they were, that is why they had a dispute. And the dispute is going to revolve around the question of what is the status. We've talked about this before, but never in this detail. What is the status of the Jewish people prior to receiving the Torah? We know that Avraham kept the entire Torah. Hashem himself says that Avraham kept the entire Torah. If you hold the place on 198 and turn back to Parashas Toldos, on page 128, Hashem appears to Yitzchak after Avraham's death and tells him that he should not worry, that Hashem will take care of Yitzchak, and he will give him the land that he promised to Avraham. And then in Pasuk Hey, verse 5, Hashem says to Yitzchak, why am I going to protect you and I'm going to take care of you? Ekev asher shama Avraham bekoli, because Avraham listened to my voice. Vayishmor mishmarti, he guarded my safeguards. Vayishmor mishmarti, mitzvosai, my commandments, chukosai, my decrees, visorosai, and my Torahs. both the written Torah and the oral Torah. Now, even though it was not given yet, which means there was no formal transmission of the Torah from Hashem to man, nevertheless, the great righteous ones were given an individual transmission of the Torah, which means they knew what the Torah was going to say. Noach, we know, Rashi tells us, he studied Torah, even though the Torah had not been given yet. How do we know Noach studied Torah? Because the Torah itself writes that Noach was to take two of each animal, male and female, two of each animal, except for one type of animal, one group of animals, he was to take seven males and seven females. And which group was that?
I think
kosher animals. Kosher animals, he was to take 7 males and 7 females, because after the flood was over, he offered some of them as sacrifices to God. And of course, if there would only have been 2 of them, he couldn't offer them as sacrifices, because then it would have been extinct. So he had to take extra ones to be able to offer as sacrifices. So he took the kosher ones, he took more than one and one, one male, one female. He took 7 of each, 14. So Rashi says, well, how did he know which ones were kosher, which ones weren't kosher? Rashi says, you see that Noach knew the Torah. Abraham knew the Torah. So we see then that the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, which takes place after we get out of Egypt, and it's, in fact, it's this coming Shabbos is Parshas Yisro, when we are going to receive the Torah. And that's in front of the entire Jewish nation of at least 3 million people. It's true that's when the Torah was given, but it does not mean that there was no one who knew the Torah before it was given. There were great ones who knew the Torah. However, there was clearly a difference between before the Torah was given and after the Torah was given. So what was that difference? Now, we've talked about this many times on the following level. We've said many times in the past that one major difference between before the Torah was given and after the Torah was given is that before the Torah was given, we were a family. We were the children of Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. We were their children. And it was a family. And you could not convert to join the family. You can't simply turn yourself into someone else's family. So how do you join someone's family?
You marry
into the family. That's how a person joined the family, was through marriage. After the Torah is given, and then we are a nation. We're not a family anymore. We are the nation of Jews. And once you're a nation, then there can be the concept of conversion. And so before the Torah was given, it was impossible to join the Jewish people without marrying into the family. Now, just one point before I take your question. Even before the Torah was given, there may have been a process of conversion before marriage. Meaning that before one of the tribes married a woman, if he married a woman who was not from the line of Yaakov, which, according to one opinion, all the brothers married women who were not their sisters, so then there it could very well be that those women who married had to go through a conversion. But the conversion didn't make them Jewish, because there was no such thing as being Jewish. There was such thing as being the family of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So the conversion only made it possible for them to marry a Jewish man. Once they married, now they were part of the family. But the marriage was required. Without the marriage, they still wouldn't be part of the family, even with going through the process of conversion. Today, if someone decides to convert to Judaism and never marries, they're still Jewish. When they die, they're buried in a Jewish cemetery. They're Jewish. They're full-fledged Jews when they convert. You don't need to marry to become Jewish. All you need to do is go through the process of conversion. But back then, since we weren't a nation yet, there had to be a marriage into the family in order to join the family. So that's a major difference before the Torah was given and after the Torah was given. But we're going to talk about a more complicated and also more fundamental difference as we go on this evening. Yes?
So Noah, well, we wouldn't really consider him part of the Jewish nation. But
correct.
Is he considered part of this family?
He preceded.
So kids always ask me, was Noah Jewish?
Right. So he was not Jewish. He preceded the family. He preceded. So anybody who came before Abraham certainly couldn't be part of Abraham's family, because there was no Abraham's family yet.
So what was the...
What was the name of the family?
No, what was the precedent or whatever, who studied Torah and who didn't?
So if a person was a big enough tzaddik, he was righteous enough, then apparently Hashem made it available to them through prophecy that they would know what the Torah says.
Is there anyone else besides
We know that Adam...
Yeah.
Adam kept the Torah. We assume that Mesushalach kept the Torah because he was a great tzaddik. Shem taught Torah. Shem, Noach's son, had a yeshiva. That's where Yaakov studied Torah. So he had a yeshiva to teach Torah. So there was Torah. But it was not given to an entire nation. It was anybody who was righteous enough could tap in to God in a way that God would give them the knowledge of the Torah. But it still was not the same thing as later on.
Rabbi, does that really what we mean by the oral Torah in that era?
Okay. That's a very good question. We know that after the Torah is given, we have the written Torah, which we have here in front of us,
yes.
And we also have the oral Torah. They were both given on Mount Sinai, and one goes together with the other. You can't have one without the other. One without the other doesn't make any sense. You need the oral Torah and the written Torah. They work together in tandem. Herman is asking that before the Torah was given, there was no written Torah. There was no scroll. So therefore, it would have to all be oral. What else could it be?
Correct.
Right. You would have to say that. There was nothing written down that they would be able to read from. There were no tablets. There was nothing. So you'd have to say it was all by word of mouth. Yeah.
So did they get as much as they needed, or did they get all of it?
That I don't know. I don't know. See, Bert is asking, did it depend? Like, if you were this righteous, so did you get some of the Torah? And if you became that righteous, you got more of the Torah, right? Did it work like that? Or was it, as soon as you crossed a certain threshold, you were given the whole thing? I don't know. I don't know the answer.
The Torah, that means that's plural?
Plural, right. He kept both Torahs, the written and the oral, but as Herman is pointing out, there was no physical written Torah.
Yeah, but there couldn't because the stories hadn't happened yet. Only up to here it happened.
Well, that's a different question. That gets into a different question. Hold on, we'll deal with that in a minute. Yes?
But the fact that we already know that there's two, even this early.
That's correct. We already know that there's two.
And the first two parts, is that compared to Shabbos, the safeguard, and
the Gemara says, the Talmud tells us that Avraham even kept what the sages would decree later. Mm-hmm. He even kept the rabbinic decrees that would come later. He was even able to figure out that which the rabbis would later on add to the Torah. So there, it was a totally fully encompassed Torah.
So we say we'll that's have to do my safeguards and my commandments. That would be
different types of things, right? Right. Now, Mrs. Kaiser is bringing up, and we're going to get too far afield if we continue along this route, but Mrs. Kaiser is bringing up that, well, one second, how could they have kept the Torah? How could there have been a Torah? These stories didn't happen yet. And the Torah is written in a story form. The whole Torah is written in a story form. Even those parts of the Torah that are just law after law after law, but the way that the Torah begins is, the way those sections of laws begin is, God spoke to Moshe saying, and this is what he told him. So it's told as a story. Either we're told the actual story, the man fell, and the Jews did this, and the Jews did that, either that, or we're told the story, God spoke to Moshe and told him, and we get a quote of what God told Moshe. So it's all told in a story form. So if the stories didn't happen yet, how could there be a Torah? So the answer is that the Torah apparently, and this is something which is really beyond our full comprehension, but apparently the Torah has several forms, and the form it was in the Torah, the Gemara tells us the Torah existed before the world was created. It already existed. The Talmud says, I will tell you what it says, but I don't pretend to understand it. Don't bother asking. But the Talmud says that the Torah before the world was created was a black fire on top of a white fire. Eish shechora agabi eish lavana, which means, just like you have the printed text, the Torah scroll, is black ink on top of a white parchment. It was a black fire on top of a white fire. What does that mean? I have no idea. But it existed prior to the creation of the world. That's what the Gemara says. Now, it couldn't have possibly had the stories that we have today, because the stories happened later. So, whatever form it was in, it encompassed all of the laws of the Torah, but apparently it didn't take the form that we have it today. That form that was in before the stories happened, that's what our ancestors had. That's what Avraham had, that's what Noah had, that's what Adam had, that's what Methuselah had. Not the stories that we have later on. That's clear, because the stories didn't happen. Not only that, the stories didn't have to happen in the way that they're going to happen. That was because of free will. We sinned with the golden calf, that didn't have to happen. That's because we chose to sin. We sinned with the spies, that's because we chose to sin. That didn't have to happen. So the Torah gets shaped based on what the Jews do later on. So that's a very, very difficult concept to fully understand, but that's the general idea. So this is one part of the difference prior and post the giving of the Torah on Har Sinai. But as I said, there's a more fundamental question. And the fundamental question is this. We know that today, we're now going back to page 198. Let me make a bracha before I continue. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam shecha kol mi yabivara. We know that today there are Jews and there are non-Jews. And we know the Torah addresses both Jews and non-Jews. We know the Torah has laws for Jews and the Torah has laws for non-Jews. There are 613 commandments. Some of them are prohibitions, some of them are commandments. But there are 613 rules that we have to follow as Jews. And how many do non-Jews have?
Seven,
according to most opinions. There are some opinions that give them up to 11. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, the different opinions. But at least 7. Now, those 7 that the non-Jews have overlap with our 613. For instance, one of the laws a non-Jew has is he's not allowed to kill. Well, we're also not allowed to kill. Another law is he's not allowed to steal. Well, we're also not allowed to steal. Another law is he's not allowed to be involved in certain prohibited relationships. We're also prohibited in certain relationships. He's not allowed to curse God. We're not allowed to curse God. He has to believe in one God. We also have to believe in one God. So the laws they have and the laws we have, they overlap. Just we have a lot more than they do. There are, however, subtle differences between their laws and our laws, even when we have the same law. And I'm going to show you a subtle difference in a moment. I will show you a couple of differences. The question, the fundamental question that one can ask is, what was the status of the Jewish family? I don't want to say Jewish people. We'll say the Jewish family prior to the giving of the Torah. Did they have a status of Jews, or did they have a status of non-Jews? Now, what do I mean to say? It says that Abraham kept all 613 mitzvos. So clearly he at least accepted upon himself the status of a Jew. Well, that's fine. But the question is, were they considered Jews even in a situation where it might be a leniency, where being a non-Jew might be a stringency? Now that doesn't seem logical. It would seem that it's more stringent to be a Jew because we have so many more mitzvos. The non-Jews have fewer mitzvos. So it seems that it's always more of a stringency to be Jewish than to be non-Jewish. But I'm going to show you a couple of nuances where the very stringency of being Jewish does lead to a leniency. Let me just tell you one case, which actually is very relevant to Yosef and his brothers. If a Jew wants to eat meat, you want to have a steak. So the Torah says, in order to make meat kosher, how does the cow have to be slaughtered? What's the process? You have to do ritual slaughter, which is shechita. Okay. Now, shechita, how does shechita take place? Shechita, and I'm sorry for being graphic over here, but we need to understand this for this section. Okay, we don't demonstrate on ourselves, but even just hand motions, it's considered to be an ayin hara. We don't demonstrate on ourselves. But the in the throat, there is the esophagus and the trachea, the windpipe and the food pipe. Those are the two pipes that go down. And those two pipes have to be severed. And they have to be severed in a very specific way, in one cut, not a chop, but a cut. And it has to be done very smoothly. And it has to be done in a very specific place. It can't be too high up on the throat or too low down on the throat. Very specific. A shaychet has to be very trained, and he has to know what he's doing. Because it's very easy to mess up. He has to know what he's doing properly. So, in order for the meat to be kosher, there has to be a very specific way of slaughtering the animal. Now, a non-Jew, had one of the 7 mitzvos that a non-Jew is commanded in, is Eiver Min HaChai, is a limb from a live animal. Both Jews and non-Jews are not allowed to eat a limb from a live animal. Now, when you say limb from a live animal, what does that mean? Obviously, if one would do the disgusting act of ripping a limb off of an animal, a live animal, Clearly, that would be prohibited. But a limb from a live animal doesn't only mean that. What happens if an animal, a cow, a chicken, unfortunately gets their foot caught in something and it becomes severed during their lifetime? The animal's still alive. And unfortunately, it got its limb severed during its lifetime. Okay, so you have a, we'll call it a drumstick from a chicken, that got severed during its lifetime. Now that drumstick is Eiver Min HaChai. That's a limb from a live animal. It's prohibited. Neither a Jew nor a non-Jew is allowed to eat that drumstick. What happens after the animal is dead? You slaughter the animal. Does that drumstick become permitted after the animal is dead? The answer is no. Even though the rest of the chicken may be permitted because it was slaughtered properly, but that drumstick is forever not kosher. It's not kosher for Jews, and it's not kosher for non-Jews. Since it became severed during the chicken's lifetime, that drumstick is forever prohibited to any human being, Jew or non-Jew, because it is Eiver Min HaChai. It was severed from a live animal.
The animal itself would still be kosher?
The animal could still be kosher if it was slaughtered properly, and if the severing of that limb did not cause the animal to become a trefa, which is a separate discussion. We don't need to get into the detail. But that limb remains treif. That limb remains prohibited to Jew and non-Jew because it was severed from a live animal. Incidentally, this is a problem. I'll tell you in a minute what the problem is. But this is a problem for non-Jews even eating non-kosher meat. You say, well, non-Jews could eat non-kosher meat. What's the problem? They don't have to eat kosher. That's true. They don't have to eat kosher. The problem is that in the slaughterhouses today, especially where chicken is slaughtered, the way that mass production works, things work so quickly that it is not so simple. Sometimes it happens that within the production of the chicken, that the limbs already begin to become severed before the animal is actually dead, and those limbs therefore are prohibited even to a non-Jew. So non-kosher meat could be non-kosher even for a non-Jew if the limbs were severed beforehand. It's a technicality, but it's a problem. It's a real problem. Now, so here you have a law that applies both to Jew and non-Jew. If you take an animal and you kill it without shechita, without ritual slaughter, so how do they do it today? I mean, you could shoot it, but how do they do it today? They usually bang it over the head. That's how non-kosher slaughter is usually done, is they bang it over the head. That's how they kill an animal. Or sometimes they use electrocution, right? Different ways of doing it. So if that would happen, so you have a regular chicken, healthy chicken, all the limbs are fine, and the chicken is electrocuted. So a non-Jew could eat that chicken. It's a dead chicken. It's not a live chicken. He can't eat a live chicken, but he could eat that chicken. That's fine. But a Jew can't eat that chicken because it's not kosher. It wasn't slaughtered properly. Okay. So that means, at least if you don't look into it a little bit more carefully, it would seem that it's more difficult for a Jew to have meat that he's allowed to eat than it is for a non-Jew. For a Jew to have kosher chicken or meat, not only do you have to make sure the limbs aren't severed before it dies, you also have to make sure to slaughter it properly. For a non-Jew to have kosher for a non-Jew, all that has to happen is it has to be dead before the limbs are severed. But it doesn't matter how it dies. What difference does it make how it dies? Okay. So it would seem, therefore, it's more stringent for a Jew and more lenient for a non-Jew. Now I'm going to turn it on its head. I'm going to show you where there is a case where it is more stringent for the non-Jew and more lenient for the Jew. How could that be? So listen carefully. For a non-Jew, what is the definition of a dead animal? For a Jew, what is the definition of a dead animal? Well, for a Jew, the definition of a dead animal is that the trachea and the esophagus, the windpipe and the food pipe, have been severed. As soon as those two pipes get severed, the animal is dead as far as we are concerned, because ritual slaughter has taken place. What about for a non-Jew? Well, for a non-Jew, there's no such thing as ritual slaughter. There's no shechita for a non-Jew. The animal has to be dead. What's the definition of dead? So the definition of dead for a non-Jew, for an animal to be dead, is that the animal has ceased any signs of life. That's right. If you hit it over the head and it falls to the ground and it's clearly has lost, it's not, the heart's not beating, everything, and it's lost all signs of life, then it's dead. But what happens if you hit it over the head and it's still twitching? Which happens. It's still twitching. The muscles, the spasms are still going on. It's not yet dead. The law in the Torah is that for a non-Jew, for that animal to be considered dead, it has to be bereft of all forms of life, all signs of life. And even the twitching that can take place after death still means that it's considered alive. What do we care whether it's alive or not? Because if you chop a limb off while it's still twitching, that limb is considered ripped from a live animal. But for a Jew, that's not true. You see, for a Jew, as soon as those two pipes get severed, even if the animal is still twitching, the ritual slaughter, the shechita, has taken place. Therefore, as far as a Jew is concerned, the animal is dead. So therefore, you could have a case where you could have a drumstick which is kosher for a Jew and it's not kosher for a non-Jew. Imagine that. Let me just explain it before you ask. Which means, if you take a chicken and you sever the trachea and the windpipe and the trachea and the esophagus, you sever the two, and the chicken is still twitching. While it's twitching, a drumstick, a leg, gets severed. That drumstick is kosher for a Jew because the animal is considered dead as far as a Jew is concerned. But it is not kosher for the non-Jew because it's still twitching and that was ripped from a live animal. So an amazing twist of fate where you could have a piece of meat or chicken that is kosher for a Jew and not kosher for a non-Jew. Very rare case, but it is possible to happen. There are a few other types of twists like that, where you could have it in very rare circumstances, where for the Jew it will be okay, for the non-Jew it will not be okay. And before I get to Herman's question, the issue at hand is that before the Torah was given, and Abraham kept the whole Torah, and Yitzchak kept the whole Torah, and Yaakov kept the whole Torah, and the brothers kept the whole Torah, what about something like this? Where if you're really Jewish, that piece of meat is kosher. But if you're not Jewish, the piece of meat is non-kosher. What was their status? For us, after the Torah is given, that piece of meat is kosher. But before the Torah was given, you can accept upon yourself any stringency you want. You want to accept upon yourself, you want to stand on your head 6 hours a day? Gesundheit, be my guest. You want to do it? Fine. But you can't decide that what is non-kosher for me will become kosher all of a sudden. You can't just snap your fingers and say it's okay. So what was their status? Were they allowed to be lenient on those things that for a non-Jew are really prohibited? That's the question at hand. This was the raging debate between Yosef and his brothers. And we'll describe it more in detail as soon as we answer Herman's question.
Rabbi, maybe I misunderstood you, but I thought initially you said that the drumstick is never kosher. Never.
If,
but yet you're talking about it.
If the drumstick is ripped from a live animal, a fully live animal, it never becomes kosher again. But here we're talking about where the animal is sort of dead, but not dead. It's dead as far as we're concerned, but it's not dead as far as a non-Jew is concerned. So that drumstick will be kosher for us and not kosher for them. That's the difference. But you're right, if it happens before that point, you know, the animal's fully alive, then it'll be non-kosher forever for everybody.
But there's certain parts of the animal that are not kosher, period, like the heart.
For us.
For us.
For them it'll be kosher. They don't have, we're not allowed to eat blood, they are allowed to eat blood. Right, yeah. So there are certain things that you can't kosher. the heart is very difficult to make kosher. It is possible, but it's very difficult to do because it's full of blood. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to do. Yeah.
If a non-Jew wanted to keep the seven Noahide laws, would they be vegetarian? Because how would they know what meat to eat?
And they would have to investigate and know how these how the slaughter was done. There are a group of Noahides. There are people out there who are very careful to keep the Noahide laws. When my Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Weinberg, of blessed memory, was still alive, he used to get shilas. He used to get questions from this group about details about how to keep the seven laws properly. He used to get questions like that. And he would answer. He would, you know, they want to do what's right. He would explain to them what's right.
It's a big group of them here in Atlanta.
Is there really?
Yes.
Okay. So he would get questions and he would explain to them. Yeah. Let me give you another example. This is the only other one I'm going to do. They are complicated. Any example I'm going to give you is complicated. There's no way to avoid it. It involves a nuance in the law because they're not common. Almost always, whatever is prohibited for them will be prohibited for us. It's very, very rare you're going to have the reverse. But we need to understand that there are cases. I'm going to give you one more case. You know, in a Jewish marriage, we know that there are two steps to the marriage. There is what is called kiddushin, and there is called chuppah. What is kiddushin? Kiddushin means consecration. What is kiddushin? Kiddushin is when they're standing there, they've walked down the aisle, and they are under the chuppah, but this is still not the part called chuppah. We'll get the chuppah in a minute. But they're standing under the chuppah, and the rabbi says to the groom, "Do you have the ring?" And he goes, right, but he finds the ring, and the witnesses look at the ring and make sure the ring has the value of at least a pruta, and the kala puts out her finger, and the chasam, the groom, says, "Harei at mikudeshes li b'tabazu kedas Moshe v'Yisrael, you should be consecrated to me with this ring according to the law of Moshe and Israel," and he puts it on her finger. At that point, she is consecrated. They've had kiddushin. And those who are standing there, the witnesses and the rabbi, say mazel tov, right there. Even though they haven't stepped on the glass yet, they haven't finished yet. But at that point, this woman is a married woman. But then there's a second step. The second step is called chuppah. How does chuppah work? So chuppah, there's actually a dispute how chuppah works, and we do both. We do both because we're not sure which one is right. One opinion of chuppah is that the chasan and kala stand under the canopy and we recite certain blessings and we make them husband and wife. That's called chuppah according to one opinion. According to another opinion, they have to go into a room alone where they are able to be in seclusion for a few minutes. And that's what completes the marriage. So we do both. We, under the chuppah, after the ring is put on her finger, then there are certain blessings that are recited, and the kesuba is given to her, etc. And then afterwards, we dance the happy couple to a room where they are in seclusion for a few minutes, and then they come out and take pictures for an hour and a half. So that's the two steps of marriage. That's kiddushin and chuppah. The consecration and the chuppah. That's the two parts. And that's marriage. Now, that woman who has had kiddushin, the ring was put on her finger, what happens if at that point she says, "You know what? I'm getting cold feet. I don't want to go further. I want to stop here." Well, she could stop, but she has to get a get. She would have to be divorced with a divorce document because she is married. She is married. What would happen if, God forbid, this woman would now go and live with another man and there would be witnesses to the act? They would be put to death for adultery. That would be a clear act of adultery. Even though they haven't had the second step called chuppah yet, nevertheless, she is a married woman. That's it. So those are the two steps of marriage. What about for a non-Jew? How does the Torah define a non-Jewish marriage? Now you'll say, well, when the justice of the peace or the pastor says, I now pronounce you man and wife, then they're married. Well, it's hard to say that because the Torah has to have a definition of marriage. Now, why do the Torah need to have a definition of marriage for non-Jews? What does the Torah care whether a non-Jew is considered married or not? Whether we're considered married or not, we understand why it's important. But what difference does it make for a non-Jew? But remember, one of the seven Noahide laws is, it's not don't commit adultery, it's don't commit certain acts of certain relationships that are prohibited. One of them is adultery. So non-Jews are also prohibited to commit adultery. So we have to know what is considered a non-Jewish marriage. Because who can't commit adultery? If you have a non-Jewish woman who the justice of the peace has pronounced her man and wife with another man, and then she goes and lives with a different person, has she committed adultery? Has she or hasn't she? That depends on whether we agree with the justice of the peace. Is that called marriage? So how does the Torah define a non-Jewish marriage? So the Rambam Maimonides writes as follows. He writes that, you know what a non-Jewish marriage is? A non-Jewish marriage is that when a man and a woman, any man and any woman who are not Jewish, decide that they would like to live together as a family, I don't mean with children, but as a unit, as a husband and wife, they've designated each other as their special someone, and they're going to live together under the same roof, that's marriage. That is, as far as the Torah is concerned, that's marriage. Now you understand what that means? That means you have
a proposal.
Well, they don't need a proposal. You have
significant other.
Significant other, that's correct. You have a man and a woman who are living in the same house, same apartment, whatever it is, and they're just together, and they haven't formally gotten married as far as the justice of the peace is concerned. As far as the tax returns are concerned, they're not married, but they're living together. They look at each other as being their special someone, their significant other. As far as the Torah is concerned, they are married. They are married.
But even the secular view that is common law marriage.
Perhaps.
Does that apply to both Jews and non-Jews?
No, only non-Jews.
Well, this is unfortunately happening in a lot of the younger generation.
I know that. But listen to the major difference that we'll see over here. So then, how does a non-Jew become divorced? How does a non-Jew become divorced? We have to give a get. We have to give a divorce document. How does a non-Jew become divorced? The Rambam writes, as soon as man and woman decide that they are no longer going to live together, they decide we are not going to be significant others of each other anymore, or one of them decides I'm not interested anymore, and they move out, they're not married anymore. That's divorce. No document is necessary. No formal court case is necessary. They can decide to be married, decide to be divorced. That's all that's necessary.
As far as the Torah is concerned.
That's right.
But legally,
anything more than that. Right.
More than
that's correct. But here's the catch. So if I were to ask you, as far as the Torah is concerned, remember the Torah is addressing itself to non-Jews living anywhere in the world, not just in the United States, non-Jews living in South America, in Africa, in the Far East, in the Far North, in Europe, all non-Jews, and not just now, but non-Jews over the past several thousand years. This is considered marriage and divorce for non-Jews. Now, so if I were to ask you, which is more stringent and which is more lenient, I would say that is more difficult for a Jew to get married, and it's more difficult for a Jew to get divorced. For in order for a Jew to get married, you have to go through this whole rigmarole with the ring and the witnesses and the chuppah. You have to go through the whole business. To get divorced, you got to go through the whole process with the get, with the divorce document. It's not a simple matter. For non-Jews, it's a snap. Two people decide we want to be married. I should say two people. A man and a woman decide they want to be married. Then they're married. Then the man and woman decide they don't want to be married. They're divorced. It's very simple. It's very easy. So it's more lenient. It's easier for a non-Jew than it is for a Jew, which is what we would expect. That's what we would expect. The laws are more stringent for Jews. We have more details. We have more ritual. There's more that a Jew has to do than a non-Jew. Okay, that's part of the, that comes with the territory. That's for the chosen people. It comes with the price tag.
Do these laws also apply in Israel? If you've got non-Jews coming into the city,
what do they do today in Israel? I have no idea how they work it out today. I don't know what they do. So again, it seems more lenient for Jews than for non-Jews. But I'm going to tell you a case where it could be more stringent for the non-Jew and more lenient for the Jew. How could that be? Well, what happens if a Jew and a non-Jew, two Jews, a man and a woman, the younger generation, like Herman put it, two Jews, man and woman, they decide they would like to live together. And they don't go through the process of the ring and the witnesses and the rabbi. They don't do it. They just say, we're going to live together. Maybe they even go to the justice of the peace. And we're going to live together as husband and wife. And we're going to be the significant other of each other. Now, as far as the Torah is concerned, are they married?
No.
They are not married. They may consider themselves married. The United States government might consider themselves married, may consider them married, but the Torah does not consider them married. So you have this Jewish couple that just decides to live together. Torah says they're living together in sin. They're not married. Two non-Jews do the same thing. Torah says they are married. They're not living in sin. They're married. Okay. What happens if this woman now goes and lives with another man while she's still considered the significant other of this first man? They're still officially living together, and she commits quote unquote adultery. Well, think about it. As far as the Torah is concerned, the two Jews aren't married. Therefore, she has not committed adultery. She's not a good woman. She may be acting in a promiscuous fashion, but she did not commit adultery. We will not put her to death for her act, even though she has quote unquote cheated on her significant other. But they're not married because they didn't go through the ring. They didn't go through the witnesses. They didn't go through the rabbi. They didn't do any of that stuff. They're not married. But if that non-Jewish woman will cheat on her man and go to another man, that is adultery. And therefore, as far as the Torah is concerned, she should be put to death along with the man that she lives with because she committed adultery. So here you have what seems to be a stringency for Jews and a leniency for non-Jews. You can have a technicality where it becomes more lenient for the Jew and more stringent for the non-Jew.
But Rabbi, in a marriage, unfortunately, is occurring to a great extent. And when that happens, for instance, how do you treat a non-Jew that is different from a Jew in a circumstances like that?
I mean, where it is an intermarriage?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, an intermarriage, it would be this. Well, it's a good question. As you're asking, with an intermarriage, how would it work? Are they considered?
Right.
Do you follow the laws of the Jews or the non-Jews? Most likely, it will follow the laws of the Jew because they, as far as the Torah is concerned, they can't be married at all anyway. Marriage doesn't work. So therefore, they just won't be married. That's all. Yeah.
Now, you say according to the Torah, these are the laws for non-Jews. But does the Torah give the Jews the right to enforce these laws on non-Jews?
Yes. If we have a Torah-run government, which we don't have, the state of Israel is not run by Torah, but if we have a Torah-run government and there are non-Jews living in our country, which they may, but if they do, then they have to abide by the seven Noahide laws. And we will not enforce upon them the laws. For instance, if a Jew violates Shabbos, there'll be certain penalties. If a non-Jew, well, they don't have to keep Shabbos, do whatever they want. But they are going to have to keep the laws that do pertain to them.
So under the time of the Jewish kings?
Yeah, in the time of the Jewish kings, if there were non-Jews living in Israel, they would have to abide by the seven Noahide laws, correct? Yeah. Yeah.
What happens in an intermarriage with the children of a Jewish woman?
Well, we know that it follows the woman. Right?
No, the children are Jewish.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're not, the children are Jewish, but their parents, the Jewish woman and the non-Jewish man, are not married.
Right.
Even if they consider themselves married, the Torah does not consider them technically married.
And why the two women are just Jewish?
They're Jewish. They're Jewish. That's all.
Relationship.
What's that?
But they're from forbidden relationships.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there's a lot of forbidden relationships that go on. Okay, now, let me show you where what the situation I just described to you actually comes up. Now, let me just make sure I don't run myself here into circles, because we're getting into very technical points over here. Okay, now, we have a few more minutes before we run out of time. This is it. After tonight, we're not going back to this. This is it. Okay. So, Yosef felt that although the brothers were keeping the Torah, however, they could not be lenient where the non-Jews were stringent. They had to keep, they could keep the Torah all they wanted, but in a case where it was more difficult, so to speak, to be not Jewish, they had to be like the non-Jews. So for instance, with this case of the limb being cut off the animal after the slaughter, but while the animal was still twitching, Yosef would say, that limb is not kosher, you can't eat it. The brothers said, no, we're Jewish. And we're Jewish even when there's a leniency. And therefore, we are allowed to eat that limb. These are the types of things that Yosef and his brothers differed about. This is before the dreams. This is before the jealousy of the dreams. This is just the issue of what is the technical law. You see, this is the only verse we're going to do tonight. If you look, we read this verse last week. Again, on 198 in Pasuk Beis, verse 2, the very end of the verse, Vayave Yosef es bibasam ra'a el avihem. Yosef brought their evil report to their father. What evil report? What were the brothers doing that Yosef was tattling to his father? Were the brothers involved in some kind of embezzlement scheme? Or a Ponzi scheme to rig the market? What were they doing that Yosef was reporting to their father? So the Medrash tells us, you know what he reported to their father? They were eating Eber min hachai. They were eating a limb from a live animal. They were eating a limb from a live animal. Even non-Jews can't eat a limb from a live animal. What, the brothers were eating a limb from a live animal? What were they? They were just so hungry they just chopped limbs off of the live animals and ate them? No. They were eating a limb off of a live animal that Yosef considered to be alive, but they considered to be dead. Because Yosef said, we're like non-Jews. You can't consider that animal dead. And they said, no, we're like Jews. And therefore we can consider the animal dead after the slaughter while it's still twitching. That was one of the three things that Yosef reported to his father. He reported that they were eating limbs from live animals. He reported that they were committing acts of immorality, which means they were involved in relationships they weren't allowed to be involved in. What does that mean? They were just being promiscuous? No, same idea. He reported that, let's say one of his brothers married a woman who had, let's say one of his, how's this going to go? This one is too technical to get into. This one we're going to leave out. But it's going to be similar to this. I'm going to explain the next one to you. But this one's too complicated. But that would be, again, it would be a case where it would have been prohibited for a non-Jew and permitted for a Jew. They're involved in prohibited relationships. I said, no, we're not. We're Jewish. And the third thing he reported is they're treating the children of Bilhah and Zilpah like slaves, rather than like full-fledged members of the family. They're calling them children of shvachos, children of, not he called them slaves, but they're calling them children of maids, rather than calling them children of full-fledged Jews. Now, where does that come from? I pointed out this to you last week. In that same verse, it says, right before that line I just read you. V'hu nar, he was a young man. Espeni Vilah of Espeni Zilpa, he was with the children of Vilah and the children of Zilpa. Nishay aviv, the wives of his father. We didn't know that Bilhah and Zilpah were the wives of Yaakov. Why does it have to tell us over here they were the wives of his father? Well, really, we're very aware why it has to say this. Turn back a few pages in Parashas Vayishlach, back to the episode of Reuven with Bilhah on page 190. What does it say over there on page 190 in verse 22? In verse 22 on page 190, Vayelech Reuven went, Vayishkaves Bilhah, and he lived with Bilhah. He explained it doesn't really mean he lived with her. He moved the bed. But what does he call, what is she referred to as? Pilegesh Aviv, the concubine of his father. Well, was she a concubine? Or was she a full-fledged wife? Which one was she? A concubine or a full-fledged wife? Well, you know, it depends who you were talking to. If you were talking to Reuven, Reuven would tell you, she's a concubine. If you're talking to Yosef, Yosef's going to say she's a full-fledged wife. Why is that? Well, that's because when Yaakov married Bilhah and Zilpah, he married them without the Kiddushin. He didn't use the ring and the witnesses and all that. When he married Rachel and Leah, he did. He went through the regular process. Bilhah and Zilpah, who were the maids of Rachel and Leah, he didn't marry them with the Kiddushin, with the ring, etc. So, Reuven said, and the other brothers said, well, if they didn't use the ring, whatever, then they're not really married to Yaakov. Because we're full-fledged Jews. If you don't do that, you're not really married. In which case, if they're not really married, remember what we said before, you can convert to Judaism today without getting married. But back then, if you didn't marry into the Jewish people, you're still the way you were before. What were they before they married? They were maids. They were maids. As far as Reuben and the brothers were concerned, they're still maids. Because they didn't join the Jewish people. Yes, they are living with our father, but they never had the ring, the rabbi, well, I don't know who the rabbi would have been, the witnesses, they didn't have all that. And therefore, they are not considered full-fledged wives. They're only concubines, in which case they are still technically maids. So therefore, they referred to their brothers as children of maids. Now, the brothers themselves were not maids, because they come from Yaakov. So Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, who were born from Bilhah and Zilpah, were brothers. But they said to them, you are children of maids. Yosef said, they're not children of maids, because we are still technically non-Jews. Even though we may choose to keep a lot of the Jewish laws, we're technically non-Jews. So when Yaakov married them without the ring, etc., they're full-fledged wives. If they're full-fledged wives, then they are Jewish. So don't call them children of maids. They're children of the wives of our father. Just like my mother Rachel and your mother Leah were full-fledged wives, so were Bilhah and Zilpah. So the reports that Yosef gave his father were these nuances. He said to his father, they are eating limbs from a live animal. They are living with women they're not supposed to be living with. And they're calling the children of the maids, of Bilhah and Zilpah, children of maids. That's what Yosef told his father. Now Yaakov was no fool. Yaakov understood these nuances. But you see that this is already going to cause great strife. So now we've painted a greater picture over here. Last week we talked about how Yosef was already behind the eight ball. Because he's supposed to be a sort of leader, yet he's number 11 in line. But here, he was a nar. He was acting young. In what way was he acting young? It's not that he was playing video games all day. Not like that. He was acting young in the sense that he wasn't using the proper discretion in reporting to his father. He was willing to report to his father what he saw, even though it was a matter of dispute who was right and who was wrong. This is going to lead to greater strife later on. And the Medrash says that Yosef was punished on all three counts. All three counts of limb from a live animal, illicit relationships, and children of maids that he reported about his brothers, he got all three back. Because when they sold Yosef, what did they do? They took his coat, the many-colored coat, the technicolor coat, and they slaughtered an animal, ritual slaughter. They didn't rip any limbs off the animal. They slaughtered the animal, took the blood, dipped the coat in the blood, and said to their father, look what we found. What do you think happened? And he said, oh, he was torn up by a lion, by an animal. That's what happened to Yosef. That's where Yosef got back in kind, because he reported about limbs being ripped off animals. He gets punished using an animal that is slaughtered properly. When he gets sold to Egypt, he's sold as a slave. He reported that they were calling the children of maids. He gets sold as a slave. And of course, the ultimate test Yosef had to go through, the wife of Potiphar tried to seduce him, and he had to withstand the wife of Potiphar. So all three things that he reported about his brothers, he gets punished for later on. That doesn't mean to say that Yosef was right and the brothers were wrong. That doesn't mean to say Yosef was wrong and the brothers were right. There's two sides to every story, and we're going to see as we move along where the brothers' fault was. But Yosef's fault, as we see right now, is v'hunar, that he was acting in a way that did not command maturity. Yes?
I think you answered my question. I was just wondering, because Yosef was at a higher level than his brothers.
Correct.
Did that reflect in the descendants of the tribes as perhaps not being as Jewish as the others?
Excellent. Okay, so what Herman's bringing up, and this is going to be for next week already, is that what's going to happen when Yosef has the dreams is that the brothers are going to feel that Yosef is saying that he's more Jewish than they are.
Yeah.
And that the future will bring that they will be pushed out and he will be the sole heir to Yaakov. And that's going to lead to the shift. But what we're showing is that those dreams are against this backdrop that we already have in place prior to the dreams. There already is a very difficult situation between the brothers and Yosef, and then the dreams just catapult the whole thing.
I'm still swallowing this one. Yaakov, nothing happened. Why didn't he fully marry them?
Oh, with Bilhah and Zilpah?
He had to know what was going on. He could have rectified it in any
time. Well, was that? When he married them, that was before anybody was born. Or if they were born, they were 1 year old, 2 year old. I mean, this issue with Yosef and the brothers doesn't come up until long.
But it seems to me that
even if he would have rectified it, it wouldn't have helped because the children were already born. And at the time that they were born, the brothers were saying, your mothers were maids.
I guess I just see from time to time he's not as up there like with Levi and,
Yaakov? Okay, we're going to talk about Yaakov. The question with Yaakov is going to be the coat that he makes for Yosef. That's going to be the question, because that coat is going to cause jealousy. Why did he make the coat for Yosef? So then we're going to talk about that.
Did Yaakov agree with Yosef or with the brothers?
The Gemara does not take sides in this argument. It's an argument that scholars have, and we're not going to take sides in a scholarly argument. It's an important argument. But the fact is that Yosef reported. That was the problem. He could dispute. Scholars are allowed to dispute, and you can have arguments. There's nothing wrong with that. But if he goes and reports that to his father, that was a problem.
So Yosef has punished Mita Keneged Mita because of this. But basically he's saying is he was punished because of Lashon Hara, because of his brother. But we see in the law, as we look back later in the other parshas, that anyway the Jews had to get to Mitzrayim anyway, and this all...
Okay. That's a good question. And they had to end up in Egypt anyway. Yeah. Okay, we'll talk about that. Remember, in the end, the brothers sell Yosef. Right? The brothers are the ones who take that step. For all the disagreements that are going on, but the brothers are the ones who take the step. So we'll see what...